Washington, D.C. internet just yesterday. And, you know, it was significant in so many different ways, but one of them was really that it took the potential of a nuclear threat very, very seriously and is looking at ways of, you know, how that might be addressed. Sadly, that doesn't seem to be the same kind of initiative or focus when it comes to bio risks and bio threats. So that's why we thought it was absolutely timely, and in the run-up, you know, although we still do have some time for the BWC RevCon next year, to start sort of engaging on this really critical issue and see how we might want to develop a little further and see whether, you know, what we could as NGOs contribute to this process. So with that, let me turn it over to Jonathan Granoff, who leads the Global Security Initiative, to introduce our speaker and to chair the proceedings. Could I also request those of you at the back to please come join us on the main table, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
There's enough space for all.
It's really good to be here. It's great that the East-West Institute in the last 2 years has taken a real leadership role in promoting the control and elimination of weapons of mass destruction. And I want to just highlight that it was at the session that they hosted at the UN in October of last year that the Secretary General came forward with his 5-point agenda on nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament, in which there was a nod of support from Henry Kissinger. And I thought that was a real feather in the cap of PAL and the East-West Institute for seizing that opportunity. The Biological Weapons Convention is central in our security for the future. And Professor Kelman is probably the wonkiest person I know on the subject. But in addition to being professorial and an extraordinary scholar who's written extensively, particularly on the legal aspects, he's also a techie. And so he's one of the few people that I know who stretches both from the legal and the technical aspects of it. His biography has been circulated, and I'm not going to go into it because you can all read it. I presume everybody has his bio? Yeah. Good. Well, you know, the Biological Weapons, just a little bit, the Biological Weapons Convention was open for signature in 1972 while Richard Nixon was president, and sort of belies much of the garbage that we hear in the media that arms control is a Democratic Party invention. Also, you might realize that the NPT also entered into force while Richard Nixon was president. And so the Biological Weapons Convention owes a lot to Richard Nixon. He was really a driving force in its creation and its opening. It entered into force in 1975. There are now, I think, 163 countries have ratified the treaty. But the treaty really doesn't have an institutional framework comparable to, say, the Chemical Weapons Convention. In some ways, it's even more Spartan in its institutional structure than the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which also doesn't have a secretariat. There's an implementation support unit in the Office of Disarmament Affairs, and I think we have some representation from that here today, but I think the main office, I believe, is in Geneva. Is that correct? Yes. But other than that, it's really, there was an enormous amount of work done to strengthen the verification system in the treaty in the late 1990s, and there was hope that there would be a verification protocol at the review in 2001, but our hopes were fully dashed by John Bolton at that time. And most recently, Undersecretary of State Alan Tauscher notified the world that the United States will not be seeking to revive that process. But that doesn't mean that there is a failure of commitment. In fact, I would say that we're almost at a tabula rasa, and an interesting moment in which there's a political will and an institutional deficit. And between this field right now, I think it's ripe for big thinking for synoptic overview in order to write new rules of the road and new institutional structures that will be coordinated to match the political will. And Professor Kelman has, in my opinion, probably the best overview on the themes of biocriminalization, ranging from international norms to 1540, biosurveillance expertise, the proper uses of science. He's convened several conferences that I've been part of with just absolutely the top technical experts. And biopreparedness, addressing the interaction between medical and security issues. Without further ado and accolades, Professor Kelman.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Thank you, Paul, for organizing this, and to all the people here from the East-West Institute and the Global Security Institute. Thank you all for coming and sharing the time. This is a most important topic, and I want to see if we can't begin to move some of the policy ball forward, and that's what I want to talk to you about today. Now, this is all in the context of the 7th Review Conference, which is going to be held, the 7th Review Conference for the Biological Weapons Convention, which will be held at the end of 2011. And at that conference, decisions will be made about how the treaty will advance over the next five-year period. The way the treaty works is that the intermediate 4 years are devoted between each review conference are devoted to what's called an intersessional work plan. And every year there is a specific topic that receives attention, and then the topic changes for the next year, etc. It is at the review conference when the four topics to be examined are chosen. And that makes a great deal of difference about how the treaty will advance. If we choose topics that go to the nub of the problem, if we choose topics on which progress is possible, then that whole process becomes rich and we can move the policy ball forward. If we choose topics that are kind of off the point, if we choose topics upon which no progress is seriously possible for whatever reason, then we get together at meetings, but not much gets accomplished. So what we're trying to do here, and we've been talking, the three institutes that are represented here, including my own, the International Security and Biopolicy Institute, about how we can begin a process of discussion with diplomats internationally to frame this in a way such that when we all convene at the 7th Review Conference at the end of next year, progress is optimal. With that, let me turn to the... I can't see what's up behind me, so that's... Okay. The first point I want to make, and Jonathan talked about this, is there is both a growing sense worldwide that bio threats are very real, very dangerous. And I thought I would sort of give a graphic demonstration of that. Okay? This is highly weaponized anthrax. It's not. It's powdered sugar. I'm not a lunatic. But actually, this is what highly weaponized anthrax would sort of look like. And the difference, for all of you who are familiar with nuclear weapons, the difference is that if this were highly weaponized anthrax and properly disseminated, this could kill between 250,000 people. Now, you simply can't get that kind of bang per ounce in any other way. And let me tell you something else about this little vial. Some of you may know, most of you don't, I gather, I live in Chicago. No, I did not walk here. I flew a plane. No, I didn't put this together once I got to New York. Put this together in my home in Chicago. Yes, I carried it onto the plane with me. Yes, I do that all the time. I traveled all over the world with this vial of powdered sugar. And no one has ever so much as asked me about it. No one. It has never been noticed. It's right there in my luggage, or my handbag, actually. Okay? Now, again, I'm not a lunatic. This is powdered sugar. But if it's that easy for a middle-aged law professor to walk through airport security with a vial of white powder, then do we seriously think that guys who are malevolently intentioned can't figure out how to carry this stuff through any airport that they want to and move it anywhere they want? That's, again, another big difference from nuclear weapons. The ability to move this stuff discreetly is simply incomparable. There's one other huge difference between this and a nuclear weapon. Nuclear weapon goes off in a city, it would be absolutely catastrophic. Absolutely catastrophic. But if you're not there, you are really upset. You are really grieved. That's a horrible thing that has happened, but you are not physically affected. But let me tell you, if I can make this much weaponized anthrax, I can make barrels of weaponized anthrax. And what that means is, I can release this in New York, and of course no one would know. There's no explosion. There's no event. It's not for a couple of days until people report to emergency rooms. Meanwhile, I've gone to Dallas. And I release this in Dallas. From there, let's expand it. I go to Mexico City. From there, I go to Tokyo. From there, and you get the point. I can keep doing this and doing this, and I will always be ahead of the enforcement authorities because no one will know when I release it until 3 days later or so when people start reporting to emergency rooms. But anthrax is not our biggest worry. It is perhaps our biggest worry right now, perhaps. But our biggest worry is contagious disease. Our biggest worry, frankly, is variations of pox viruses, most notably smallpox. Smallpox, as you know, humanity's biggest killer. In our species history, more people have died due to smallpox than any other cause. We've wiped it out. A huge advance for humankind. Huge advance for humankind. Today, scientists can walk into a laboratory and synthesize smallpox. Or variants thereof, which is to say, take a monkeypox or take a camelpox and enable that to be remarkably contagious and remarkably lethal. Now, if we are talking about the release of an effectively released pox virus, we could be talking about casualties in the numbers of 100 million or more. Now, I don't mean to trivialize the threat posed by nuclear weapons, but with all due respect to Mr. Obama and the summit he's been holding for the last few days, a nuclear terrorist is never going to get more than one bomb. And with that one bomb, again, I don't mean to trivialize the implications, but we're simply not talking about anything like the numbers. This is easier to do. It is far easier to transport. And ultimately could cause far more death and disruption than nuclear weapons. I'm not saying we shouldn't focus on nuclear weapons. Please, that shouldn't be the takeaway. The takeaway is we got a problem here, folks. And we're not dealing very well with that problem. Now, the good news, and this is what Jonathan got to, and I really want to underscore it, there is a commitment. There's a commitment in Washington. There's a commitment in Brussels. There's a commitment in many national capitals. We're not the only guys out there who are saying this is a real danger. We can find in commission studies, etc. There's widespread recognition that this is a real danger, and there is a serious commitment to do something about it. So somebody like me runs an institute as a law professor by living, come to you and say, let's think about how we can take that commitment, that energy, and really move it forward. The last point I want to make on this and then move along. There's a good news story here. And the good news story is the steps that we need to take to deal with the biological threat have multiple benefits. We can accomplish a lot for humanity. And this is, again, perhaps another difference between the bio threat and the nuclear threat. The nuclear threat is a self-contained issue in which we have to deal with it in very self-contained ways. Not so here. Not so here. To deal with the bio threat, we have to do things that have benefits for public health, benefits for biological science, benefits for economic development, benefits for international relations, and I'm going to talk about that. Okay? There is a good news story. If we make the world safer from biological threats, we can make the world a better place to live in. We can flip the page. What I'm going to talk to you about is a four-topic work plan, as I say, for the next review conference. But I want to get across to you, and I realize some of you are from the Disarmament Commission. I regret to say this, but I think we have to put it right out there on the table. There is no such thing as biodisarmament. It is not a concept. It is not, it's a Zen phrase that has no meaning. We will never, in our lifetimes, our children's lifetimes, our grandchildren's lifetimes, I can't tell you about 1,000 years from now, but in the far foreseeable future, we will never be at a point where we can even fantasize about zero biothreats. This is the human condition at the beginning of the third millennium. There are capabilities out there to use disease for violent purposes. And there is nothing we can do that can reduce those threats to zero. This is not a disarmament challenge per se. This is a risk management challenge. This is a challenge about how we make it really hard for bad people to do it, and we make it really ineffective if they try. It is a combination, in a word, of prevention, how do we stop them from doing it, and preparedness, how do we minimize the damage if they do. Okay? And here I want to focus on those two bullets just for a moment. Nuclear weapons technology, in a very real sense, has not fundamentally changed since the late 1940s. Yes, I know there have been advances and such, but what a nuclear weapon is, it's essentially defined in the 1940s. And we're pretty much dealing with that phenomenon now. Okay? Not so in bio. Not so in bio. The nature of the threat itself, the inherent thing, changes with incredible speed. Okay? And that poses a unique challenge. Second, and this is the point I was getting at a moment before, that which is dangerous is simply and entirely identical to that which is of enormous benefit. The same thing, the same techniques, the same science, the same items that we worry about are the items that are conveying magnificent benefits to human life. So again, it's not a question of eliminating them. We don't want to eliminate them. We want to minimize the risks associated with them. Now I'm going to talk about four topics. I'm going to talk about them very briefly, because after all, this is not the review conference. This is not where we have to do this, the really hard work. I want to get across to you the strategy that I think would be optimally beneficial. Four topics: biocriminalization, Jonathan mentioned, promoting secure bioscience, biosurveillance for compliance, and global biopreparedness. And my rest of my talk will be on this. And I really want to move very quickly, because the interesting part for me is hearing from all of you. I listen to myself all the time. I get bored. So you'll excuse me while I go through this. We can say a lot of things about biothreats. Many, many things about biothreats. We can disagree on a lot of things, but one thing is fundamental. It's a crime. Whoever does it, it's a crime. It's done by a state actor. It's a crime. It's done by a terrorist. It's a crime. It's done by a lunatic. It's a crime. This is our most fundamental, long-standing norm. to intentionally inflict disease is wrong. Humanity's entire history has been a battle against disease. We have been confronted with disease since before we were humans. It is our dearest dread. I don't know how many of you are in the room, our parents, but every one of you knows your greatest nightmare is your children getting sick. That is bred into us for millennia of human evolution. And it is wrong to intentionally inflict disease. I can think of no norm, and I do understand the Ten Commandments, I can think of no norm that is as deeply embedded into the human experience that it is wrong to intentionally inflict disease. This goes way, way before the Biological Weapons Convention, and of course the Biological Weapons Convention embodies it. Okay? Now, we have 1540, and 1540 tells us that criminal laws have to be passed with regard to the use of weapons of mass destruction, including biological weapons. But there are some important gaps that I think we need to think about. First of all, we need to criminalize the unauthorized work on pathogens that could lead to biological weapons. If we have some maniac releasing smallpox worldwide and causing a global pandemic that is causing millions of fatalities, the fact that that person has now committed a crime is of little moment to us. We need to criminalize the conduct that leads up to that without criminalizing the legitimate bioscience that may look an awful lot like that. That's a very hard challenge to think about, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. Second, and I think that if I could ask you all as international diplomats, could we do one thing? Yes, maybe it's only symbolic. But if we could do one thing that really should be done right now, today, without even giving it a moment's argument, we should amend the Rome Statute to include the intentional infliction of disease as a crime against humanity. Okay? That in and of itself is not going to make the world vastly safer. I don't want to mislead you here. But at a symbolic level, the fact that the international legal statement about what are the highest crimes against humanity does not include the intentional infliction of disease. That's wrong. It should be changed. That is a symbolic statement of the highest order. We have to go far beyond, though. Criminalization is meaningless if we don't have police and prosecutors who understand what criminalization means. If they don't understand that this could be not powdered sugar, that this could be anthrax, if they look at this and they don't know what they're looking at, and frankly, police worldwide don't know what they're looking at, then criminalization is of limited benefit. So we have to talk about enabling law enforcement to actually make that criminalization prohibition effective. We need to be talking about bioforensics. And here, let me give you an example. We did a workshop at Interval. And the workshop involved plague, and in that sense may not have been the best example, but the point I'm going to make is not really about that. And the outbreak was first released in France and in Australia. Those two countries, relatively good relationships, and legal cooperation between them to try and find the perpetrator was sort of effective. The disease in our exercise spread to countries that, frankly, don't get along so well. Legal cooperation to find the perpetrator completely broke down. Now, what does this mean? We got a guy out there who's releasing this once, who's releasing it twice, who's releasing it three times, who's releasing it 20 times. What is the first thing we got to do? We got to get them. We got to stop them. And if there's more than one, we got to stop the group. We okay back there?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on again. Okay. The first question to Mr. Obama, if the attack is in the United States, we all know this, right? Mr. Obama, what are you doing to find the perpetrator so that it doesn't happen again? Right now, no leader, not Mr. Obama, not Ms. Merkel, no one has a good answer to that question. And if we don't have stronger law enforcement capabilities to get the bad guy off and stop him, then it will keep going, and it will keep going. Okay. Let me move on to promote secure bioscience. Now, I alluded to this a moment ago, but I want to reiterate. We got a real dilemma here. We can't just say we're going to stop science. We can't say the danger there, so anybody who works on pathogens, no. We should be welcoming this science. This science is about curing disease. This science is about human progress. We want this science. What we should be, so that's why the first word, the verb in this phrase, is important. It is promotional. We want to promote science. But we want to, in that promotion, get across the idea that unfortunately there's an aspect of this science that poses an incredible danger. And therefore, we have to be talking about promoting secure bioscience. Now, the first bullet here is well understood. We need to be talking about the physical security of laboratories. There are laboratories in the world where I'm told you can walk in and you can walk out with anything you want. Well, that's not good. That's not good. We simply have to realize, yes, we welcome the science, but the science has to observe some rules. This is conduct that is potentially dangerous, and we need to think about it. More important, I think, we need to know where the pathogens are and where they are moving. Now, fortunately, right now, we're not talking about that many pathogens. We're talking about anthrax. We're talking about pox viruses. We're talking about tularemia. We're talking about various toxins, including botulinum and ricin. We're talking about a relatively contained category of pathogenic agents. The rest of bioscience, the bioscience that is dealing with cancer, heart disease, the bioscience that is making the next Viagra, fine. We're not worried about that. We're worried about a very small segment of bioscience, and this is what needs to be contained. Okay? Now, somebody wants to work on pox viruses. We ought to say, that's fantastic. That's a great thing. Okay? Let us know. Government should know, not because it should be prohibited or struck down, no. But we simply should have that dimension of transparency such that we know where this work is being done. And if I'm working on a pox virus here, and you're working on a pox virus a quarter of the way around the world, and you need the strain that I am working with, I should be able to ship that strain to you under secure conditions. But here's the point. The fact that it is leaving my laboratory should be recorded. And the fact that it is going to your laboratory and eventually is received in your laboratory should be recorded. We need a census of these pathogens. We need to know where they are. We need to know where the traffic is. We need to know that they are being safely transported and stored wherever they are. And along with this, and please look at this bottom bullet because it is very important. All of you are familiar with the Millennium Development Goals, and you know the role of bioscience and biotechnology in the development goals. We need to build this into and as a fundamental part of a global development agenda that values bioscience as a contributor to global economic and health development. That is a crucial aspect here. Okay? This is very important for much of the world, not simply the developed nations. In fact, I would argue it's more important for the less developed nations. And we need to talk about a security agenda that is a composite of a development agenda, that doesn't detract but rather adds to that development agenda. So, for example, a small startup biotech in some less developed part of the world wants to go to the investment capital community and gain the resources that are necessary to enter the global marketplace for whatever it is that they are trying to produce. We ought to make that easy, but we also ought to say to the investment community, a condition of you providing the capital for that biotech startup is awareness that that biotech has security obligations. And we ought to give benefits to the companies that understand their security obligations, and we ought to provide some barriers for those companies that do not. Third, biosurveillance for compliance. Now, this leads to an issue that Jonathan and I have known each other since before there were...
1980s.
Yeah, well, I was going to even go longer than that. But yes, you're probably right. And this may be a little bit of an issue where Jonathan and I have a bit of a difference of opinion. I think devoting effort to talk about verification in the biological weapons context is simply a waste of time. It simply cannot be done. This is not a legal issue. This is not a political issue. This is a technological issue. Okay? It's too easy to clean it up. It's too easy to hide it. All we are going to do is waste an enormous amount of time and resources confirming that people that we're never worried about are in fact not to be worried about, while we are doing absolutely nothing to try and find the bad guys who we are worried about. Resources are not unlimited. We cannot seriously be going into the international community and saying, let's devote extraordinary resources to do something that's of limited value. We need to be talking about how can we be focusing resources on finding the bad guys. That ultimately is what we're about, right? Is making sure that people are not exposed to these threats. So what I talk about is how can we increase our capabilities to detect non-compliance with the norm? How can we find out who is doing wrongful behavior, and how can we stop them before they do it? And if they do it, how can we find them and hold them legally accountable? This all leads to the word biosurveillance. And what biosurveillance is a very complicated concept, but in its essence, it is pulling together enormous strains of information from all sorts of different communities that allow us to have a picture about what is going on out there. It's important to understand, now this is a chemical problem, not a bio one, but I think it's relevant. Aum Shinrikyo attacked the Japanese subway in the mid-1990s with sarin gas, left telltale signs all over the place as they were developing. First they tried bio, and that was unsuccessful, and then chemical. Police didn't have the capabilities to retrieve that information, put it together, and understand what they were looking at. The evidence very often is there. Let me give you another example. Veritech, a private company, identified the outbreak of H1N1 in Mexico 18 days before CDC or WHO had any idea that there was a problem. Okay, now that's a natural outbreak, I understand. But the point is there are techniques for identification of wrongful conduct, there are techniques for identification of outbreaks of disease that we can advance on a global basis that will give us a much better picture about what is happening. What do we get out of that? We get a lot of mutual confidence. Remember, we don't want to castigate bioscience. We want to have confidence that bioscience is being used for legitimate purposes. I think more important, bioscience is the fastest proliferating industrial activity in the world. Okay? What does that mean? It means the capabilities for doing something wrongful are proliferating all over the world. It also means the capacities for the guy on the next bench to say, what's that guy doing over there? And calling authorities and saying, this is something you might want to be aware of because there's something that doesn't add up here. Though that's proliferating all over the world. And this is something we want to encourage, is we want to encourage the communication between the bioscience community and law enforcement authorities so that there is early warning of wrongful behavior. And when there is some outbreak, we want to know about it instantly. Again, a nuclear weapon goes off. You don't need information resources to know about it. Okay? PETN blows up an airplane, you don't need information resources to know about it. It's known instantaneously. But with bio, you need sophisticated mechanisms to know about it in time to do something about it. And this is a very real challenge. And here's something that I want to stress. It's the last bullet on this page. Building biosurveillance techniques that are effective at identifying non-compliant behavior with the biological weapons prohibition will have multiple benefits, because those same techniques will better enable us to detect natural disease outbreaks. It will better enable us to understand what is going on in terms of environmental degradation and despoliation. We can, by promoting biosurveillance for the objective of security, we can accomplish benefits for public health, environmental protection, etc. This is what I was getting at a moment ago when I said there are multiple benefits. Speaking of multiple benefits, let me go to the fourth part of this, global biopreparedness. And under that, you'll see that the Global Health Security Action Group, which is the G7 plus Mexico ministers of health, have an initiative on global biopreparedness. I think it's an extremely progressive move. I want to see it advanced more rapidly, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. What is global biopreparedness? Global biopreparedness is having stockpiled medicines, medical countermeasures, what goes under the acronym MCMs, stockpiled, connected to distribution networks so that those medicines can be moved to where they are needed on an extremely rapid basis, coupled with dispensation capabilities that allow, upon receipt into the country, they can be moved and put into people's arms or a pill put into their mouths with incredible speed. Now again, this gets released in, let's say, a sporting venue and 100,000 people in, you name your city, whatever city you want to name, your national capital, whatever. Okay?